And we'll say, I'm gonna sing out. I'm gonna march on. And everybody said,
I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on.
I'm gonna march on.
Gonna put one foot in front of the other foot.
I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on. Got to keep on going.
I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on.
I'm gonna march on.
When my grandmama marched.
Hi there. I'm Jeff Browning, and welcome to Benders of the Arc podcast, where we interview movers and shakers for social change.
Welcome to this conversation on pacifism. On March 20th of 2003, the United States invaded Iraq, claiming that Saddam Hussein was hiding weapons of mass destruction. The protests ahead of that invasion were the largest in U.S. history, with hundreds of thousands of people marching the streets of our country and around the world. But while thousands of people were marching in the streets, the voice of resistance and protest within our churches was virtually silent. Fewer than 1% of our churches addressed the issue from the pulpit or in some form of study or conversation. Pastors and sessions were reluctant to address this issue because they knew that many of their congregants supported the war. Among those that did preach about the war, experienced members getting up in the middle of their sermons and walking out. Then in 2004, the Presbyterian Church USA passed a resolution stating that the invasion of Iraq was unwise, immoral, and illegal. And then in 2010, the Presbyterian Church USA, again, General Assembly, adopted a peace discernment resolution that called on the church to enter into a 6-year term of discernment to seek clarity on whether God is calling the church to embrace nonviolence as its response to war and terror. During that 6-year time of discernment, a task force of pastors, scholars, and others interested did research and provided interim reports and presented their final report in 2016. While that report and the action of the General Assembly did not embrace nonviolence as its response to war and terror, it did pass 5 new peacemaking affirmations for risking peace in a violent world. That discernment process also encouraged a few churches to take a look at what it might look like for these churches to declare themselves to be peace churches. While the denomination was not ready to take such a leap, perhaps individual churches could take that step. These churches were led by pastors who were willing to lead their congregations in a conversation about violence, war, and nonviolence. In relation to our call as people of faith to follow the man we call the Prince of Peace. Then in 2018, the General Assembly of the Peace USA approved the adoption of a special designation of peace churches within the denomination. So I have invited 3 guests to join me today to discuss pacifism and nonviolence. 2 of them are or were pastors of one of the peace churches mentioned above, and the 3rd is an interim executive director of the Presbyterian Peace Fellowship. Mark Davidson retired from active pastoral ministry in the Peace USA in 2019 after 40 years of service. He was privileged to chair the 6-year peace discernment process of the denomination, culminating in the approval of the study, Risking Peace in a Violent World, and the 5 peace affirmations, which highlighted nonviolence as part of the updating of the peacemaking vision of the church. His former congregation, the Church of Reconciliation in North Carolina, is one of the peace churches in the Peace USA. As a member of the Peace Church Working Group, Mark authored three Bible studies in the Peace Church curriculum focusing on nonviolence. Mark and his wife, Allison, currently worship with the Quakers and actively support their peace testimony. Ben Daniel is the pastor of Montclair Presbyterian Church in Oakland and is a writer whose faith-based social and political commentary has appeared in a wide variety of online, print, broadcast, and video media. He's the author of three books and is active in peacemaking work in the Presbyterian Church USA. The Montclair Church is also one of the peace churches in the denomination, and Ben wrote the portion of that curriculum dealing with just war. David Ensign is a writer, musician, and Presbyterian pastor in Arlington, Virginia, where he has lived for almost 20 years with Cheryl, literally his beloved, of more years than he can remember. He currently serves as interim executive director of the Presbyterian Peace Fellowship. Prior to his role with PPF, David served two congregations in National Capital Presbytery, as well as congregations in the Presbytery of Western Reserve and Pittsburgh Presbytery. David and Cheryl have three adult children and two grandchildren, whose pictures he will happily show you. Ordained in the Presbyterian Church in 1999, David holds a doctorate in philosophy from DePaul University and has a master's in religious studies from the University of Chicago Divinity School. Prior to ordination, David was an editor and senior policy manager for the Council of State Governments. His pronouns are he, him. Well, gentlemen, it is such a pleasure to have you with us this morning. And I thought I'd begin by asking each of you to take a short amount of time, about 5 minutes, to describe your journey, your path toward pacifism, if you ascribe completely to pacifism. And since we kind of hold to the first shall be last and the last shall be first, let's start with David. David, why don't you start us off and describe your journey for us?
Sure. Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for pulling us together and inviting us into this conversation. A couple of things that you said in the introduction really jumped out at me, just took me back to places in the past along the way. And I was thinking about the evening, the night when the U.S. invasion of Iraq was announced in 2003. I spoke to a gathering in Cleveland's public square that night, and I don't remember a lot about what I said, and I'm sure that none of the 5,000 people who were there remember any of what I said, but I do remember that the litany that I invited the gathered folks to join me at the end of each paragraph was simply to declare this war is wrong. We could have said that about all of them, but we were focused in on Iraq, and that was the piece that I clearly remember from that moment. And then your reminders about the peace discernment process through General Assembly reminded me that the original overture that resulted in that work originated out of the session that in the congregation where I was pastor in Arlington. And the part of that process that I remember was that each step of the way, that work got strengthened by the conversations and the debates and discussions in each body of the church. And I found that a really powerful experience to really walk alongside. I had very little to do with the original drafting of that, in the way a lot of those things in our denomination work. that work. I was invited into that work because I was pastor of a session that would be willing to consider it in a presbytery that was likely to endorse it. But at each step of the way, it got stronger. And so much of the strengthening of that piece of work came out of various church members' take on the same simple foundational piece that is the ground of my commitment to nonviolence, and that is the witness of Jesus. And over and over and over again, in, you know, at the session level, in the presbytery, in the GA committee that heard it, I was struck by how many times people talked about the witness of the gospel as driving their commitment at whatever level that commitment was. It drove their commitment to pursue peace, to seek nonviolence, to make either declarations of pacifism or perhaps embrace of just war theory, but whatever route they were taking, they were grounding it in their understanding of the gospel claim. So when you invited me into this conversation a couple of weeks ago, and I started thinking about that central question, why are you a pacifist? My response was really simple, Jesus. Yeah. And I'm seeing Mark and Ben nod their heads in response to that. So I think this is going to be the shortest podcast episode you ever do, because you're going to ask us, why are we pacifist? And we're going to say, Jesus. So that's how I respond to your prompt. And I'll leave it there.
All right. Thank you, David. Ben, why don't you take us off next?
Yep, Jesus. Leave it there. No. So I would say that I was sort of pacifism is something that kind of came more easily to me than I think it does to other people. I was born into a family and raised by parents who were, if not strict pacifists, at least sort of anti-war hippies. You know, that the experience of protesting Vietnam and being opposed to Vietnam was something that was important in my family when I was growing up. And then I married into a family that has a, you know, strong Anabaptist background. My mother-in-law grew up in an Anabaptist church. And although my wife was raised in the Presbyterian church, the Anabaptist attitudes towards war were something that were passed on to her. And so we you know, have decided, you know, one of us comes sort of from a hippie background, one of us comes from this Anabaptist background, that created a home for us where pacifism was sort of a natural fit. I was in seminary during the first Gulf War, 1991 or 1990, when we invaded Iraq, and newly married and living in this, building a home, you know, newly married and building a home with my wife, we, you know, thinking a lot about war and about our attitudes. I would say we weren't, again, yet strictly pacifist, but certainly anti-war. And when the ground war began in Iraq, during that first Gulf War, I went to church the next Sunday where I was doing an internship, and the pastor said absolutely nothing about the war. And I thought, man, I want to hear some pastoral wisdom. I want to have my worshiping community say something about this war, which has me sort of, as a, you know, a hippie child married to an Anabaptist child, I you know, I'm feeling really uncomfortable with this. And the pastor gave me nothing. So I vowed at that moment that I would, the next time the United States entered into a ground war, I would preach about war, whatever I was feeling about it, I would preach about it. Well, fast forward, that opportunity came. We entered into a ground war in 2003, when we invaded Iraq. And I knew I was going to have to live up to my promise. And I was, again, feeling pretty opposed to this war, that particular war. I was, you know, part of that cast of thousands who were protesting the war, and I knew I needed to preach about it, and I didn't know what to say. And so I decided to look into just war theory and to present just war theory to my congregation from the pulpit and invite them, without telling them what to believe, invite them to consider the war using just war theory. I then modeled that consideration by saying, using this just war theory, this is why I'm opposed to the war, but you make up your own mind. Well, it went over like a lead balloon. I mean, people, gentle as it was, people got up and walked out. And I realized that the problem with it was the sermon was good, but it's too late. If you wait till the war starts to preach your anti-war sermon, you're way too late. So, you know, for that reason, I decided I needed to start thinking about and talking about and writing about pacifism. Or I still wasn't a pacifist yet, but I needed to start writing about issues relative to war and violence. And so I decided to endeavor to be a better student of what just war theory was saying and to pay closer attention to the violence that was going on in the world. And as a pastor and as a writer, my writing was starting to take off at this time, to speak out and to try to articulate what I felt was important on the issues. And I think that I officially decided to declare myself a pacifist after reading something by Wendell Berry, but it was about the life of Jesus. So it's still Jesus. But I read something by Wendell Berry. I think it's an essay called "The Burden of the Gospels," which is in his book, "The Way of Ignorance." And then, you know, as I was writing about, you know, I write a lot of social and political commentary that's, you know, faith based and left leaning, and I was writing about after that. Of course, I wrote a lot of stuff about the war in Iraq, and then I wrote stuff about Israel Palestine, and those were all issues where I had to sort of analyze war and violence, state-sponsored violence. I wrote a book about Islam and had to tackle the question of why, you know, there's a stereotype that Muslims are violent. And as I started wrestling with that issue, I realized Christians are more violent than Muslims. And so I started looking into Christian violence and why do we support violent things? And I was writing about the, you know, convivencia, the history of Muslims in southern Spain, and the history of violence against Muslims in southern Spain, Christian sponsored violence, which is crusades in the same way that the crusades in the Middle East were crusades, and then the Albigensian crusade in the south of France. I started reading about all these violence that Christians supported, and I realized I didn't want to be part of that. And I think the last thing that really sort of cemented the deal for me was undertaking what I hope is a faithful study of history, a faithful study of the history of war. And in that process, realizing that, first of all, no modern wars can meet the criteria for just war. Probably no wars ever could meet the criteria for just war, but certainly no modern wars can meet the criteria for just war. And then there's also the issue, as I was trying to make a faithful study of history, realizing that I don't know of a war that ever happened that worked. If war's success, and again, this is directed by just war theory, but if war's success is measured in its capacity to bring peace, then no war has ever been successful. Wars have created more wars, or wars have created the complete annihilation of an enemy. And neither one of those is peaceful in the Christian or biblical sense of what it means for things to be peaceful. So those are the things that sort of have cemented my journey towards pacifism. The sort of my background, my commitment to thinking about war pastorally, And my work as a writer and as a thinker about war subsequent to the invasion of Iraq. So that's, in a nutshell, where I stand.
Great. Thanks, Ben. Mark, why don't you finish us off here?
All right. I'm going to follow the train and say it was Jesus, just to join with my brothers on this. But I'm also going to acknowledge that I had, from the age of 10, a personal revulsion to violence. And I discovered it in the only fight I've ever been part of, which was with a neighborhood boy at the age of 10. And I didn't pick the fight. He tackled me. We're on the ground. And before we knew it, we're rolling around, throwing punches. He's throwing punches. I'm throwing punches. that went on for about a minute. So far as I know, there was never an issue. It's just we started fighting. And it ended when I was on top of him and I caught myself before pummeling him. And I said, I'm done. And I got up. And thankfully, he was done, too. So that was the end of the fight. But I don't mean to present myself as an enlightened soul at the age of 10 who saw through to the futility of violence. That wasn't it at all. I'm simply saying I didn't like being violent. And I didn't like being in a situation that brought violent responses out of me. And I couldn't have told you what pacifism was at that point, but I want to acknowledge that there was something in me as a person, in my heart, in my way of being in the world, that turned away from violence. I found it in myself. I was being violent. I inflicted harm on this neighbor kid, but I didn't like it. There was a revulsion about it. And so I want to name that as part of what I've been reflecting on in my journey. That's an interesting early metaphor for me because there was never any attempt at reconciliation between me and that neighborhood boy. When we'd see each other in the neighborhood, we'd just kind of steer clear of each other. So there was all these wounds that come from sort of this one little encounter, but it's emblematic of the kind of things that happen in conflicts. Very often the wounds are open and never really close. I think the next thing for me was I'm from the generation of Vietnam. I had a draft number. I declared myself a CO at the age of 18. I never had to meet my draft board and make that case on my own behalf, but I had done the work with my dad, who was a Presbyterian pastor and very sympathetic to pacifism, with campus ministry, both Lutheran and Catholic and Presbyterian, who were all very supportive of my quest. And then I started getting involved in protesting against the Vietnam War and found the power of being part of collective work and demonstrations. And so pacifism then wasn't simply a lonely struggle or something that grew out of my personal revulsions about violence, but it then became part of a collective vocation. It became part of what other people are doing and how to make common cause with them. In 1980, when the Presbyterian Church published Peacemaking, The Believer's Calling, I was at a tender point in my own development and vocation. I had finished seminary and was in my first position in campus ministry at Austin College in Texas. And that landed on me like a ton of bricks because it was saying the church hears you. The church wants to be involved. And Ben, it's a little bit like, where's the church speaking to me in terms of my struggle? For me, the Peacemaking, The Believer's Calling was a kind of clarion call from the Presbyterian Church to say, this is important. We want everybody to be on this journey. And I had already declared myself CO earlier and was working on that basis. I would say the other piece that I acknowledge is that when I was in my first church in 1983 in Arlington, Texas, I got to know several of the peace activists in the area and in marches, and we came across this Quaker couple, and we got to know them well, and we founded the first Fellowship of Reconciliation chapter in Fort Worth, Texas in 83. And I also experimented with what it would be like to be a peace pastor, someone who really brought that into my ministry. And I'd say with definitely with mixed results. You know, there was a lot of resistance to talking about peace in the Presbyterian church that I served there in the Metroplex. And it was kind of what Chris Hedges said in his book, War is a Force That Gives Our Lives Meaning. They were all embracing the psychological dynamics of war and the justifications of war and about social belonging and the herd mentality, and not open at all to thinking about peace. But I persisted, and I think the next thing for me that really kind of pushed me in the direction, interestingly enough, was Barack Obama's Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech. And I don't know if you remember that speech, if you studied it, but one of the things that he said in that was really disappointing for me and was a turn was he talked in a very sort of Niebuhrian way about the inevitability of war. His whole thing was war is inevitable. And I thought to myself, war is not inevitable. We might treat it as inevitable, but it is not. And we need to be about the business of evolving as a species, as Christians, as people of faith, to helping our brothers and sisters, fellow human beings, evolve into a different and better and more exalted way of dealing with conflict and finding peaceful resolutions to conflict and disputes. The idea that war is inevitable inevitably pushes us toward the Powell doctrine of full spectrum dominance. The idea is if you're going to go down that road, you better be the best armed, you better have the biggest armies, you better just go all the way with that. And I just thought that was the beginning of more of the same. And I had voted for Obama thinking he was going to be a transformational figure in politics, and he ends up bowing to the generals and the whole military-industrial complex. So at that point, I found myself thinking we have to work more at the local level. We have to find common cause, and we have to keep working in that direction. So I would say my own seminary formation, my own ministry formation, going back to early experiences, were I'm at home with the notion of peace and pacifism, and my professional life has been the ongoing struggle with that personal conviction and the messy, brutal realities of the world.
Thank you all.
Let's take a break, and when we return, I'll ask my guests about the influence of Reinhold Niebuhr, Moral Man and Immoral Society, on the conversation around pacifism. Stay with us.
And we'll say, I'm gonna sing out, I'm gonna march on. And everybody said,
I'm gonna sing out,
gonna march on.
If you are new to our podcast, please visit our blog at bendersoftheark.com, where you can find more information about our stories and the people behind them. Now let's return to our guest.
So I want us to have a conversation, and I'll try to lead us, but please feel free to jump in as you would like. Mark, I'm struck by your bringing up Reinhold Niebuhr and Moral Man and Immoral Society is a seminal book, I guess we could say, on this issue, and really making the case for war and how war, if it's not inevitable, that it's virtually impossible to have society where there is not this conflict, and that we have to be ready to address that. And I guess, you know, part of the reality is that so many folks in our congregations, you know, they have legitimate questions about this.
Yeah.
And I want to acknowledge that these are very legitimate and thorny questions for us. But how do we, reconcile that Niebuhrian urge to resist and even what you were saying, Ben, about just war and that no modern war can be just with the call for us to live in peace and to follow the Prince of Peace? Any thoughts about how we reconcile that?
I will say that I've been revisiting a classic text by a Presbyterian scholar named G.H.C. McGregor. It's an old one called The New Testament Basis of Pacifism, The Relevance of an Impossible Ideal. And in there, he just takes on Niebuhr from beginning to end. And he starts with great admiration for the intellectual force of Niebuhr and lays out his argument with a lot of accuracy and care, and at the same time comes back to pacifism as what he calls the impossible ideal and the relevance of it. It's a book I'd recommend. It's older. It's from the 40s, but it's a really ringing endorsement of pacifism while taking very seriously Niebuhr's point of view. And in the end, I think he seems to say, kind of, let us see what love can do. Let us see what working together for the sake of a world we envision and that we believe we're called to can accomplish, rather than accepting that that we have no alternative but to live with the brutalities of war.
Can I say something about Niebuhr? I confess I'm really attracted to Niebuhr's way of thinking. And I think that it's probably an American thing. You know, we're really into, we like things that work, you know, we like practical ideas. We as a people are attracted to utilitarian ideas and solutions. I think it's part of the American DNA, for better or for worse. But I know that I'm not a Niebuhr scholar, but I know he referred to his way of thinking about war as realism. I think he was someone who wasn't thrilled about war, but recognized that it was he sort of thought of it as being unavoidable. And I think he would have said pacifism doesn't work, so we have to get real, right? And what I have discovered in my attempts to be a faithful student of history is that war doesn't work. And that's part of what drives my pacifism these days. Mm-hmm. It's the observation, which I think, you know, I think I'm bringing some of that same American spirit that drove Niebuhr's thought. I think I'm bringing some of that same spirit when I say war doesn't work. It just doesn't ever bring about the desired result. So anyway, that's my admiration for what drives Niebuhr and my disagreement with where that drive takes him.
So Ben, that reminded me of two things. One, I dropped in the chat when you were talking a few minutes ago that Cleveland Plain Dealers headlined the day after the invasion of Iraq in, you know, big front page print was Bush says war to bring peace. And I remember picking that up and literally laughing out loud. I certainly had in mind, what the hippies used to say, which I'll paraphrase for the G rating of your audience, Jeff. or, making war to bring peace is about like making love to not have babies. And there was they used other words, and it was sharper than that, but it was the idea. It was just so absurd. And I laughed out loud when I saw that headline. But it does seem to be, there is this assumption that violence is a tool that works, right? There's this assumption, because it brings, allegedly, clarity and victory or defeat. It's a very binary way of dividing the world, even if it is ultimately not successful, because war does not ever bring peace. It brings endless cycles of violence and recrimination for generations. But thinking about that, Ben, as Americans, I think a deeper question beneath that for me, when I think about my own convictions around nonviolence, is that I can't help but acknowledge, recognize the incredible privileges that I enjoy as straight, white, educated male in a society where all of those are attributes that open doors that might otherwise be closed to me. So I rest on all that privilege, and I know that that privilege is upheld by institutions of an empire that's born and sustained in violence of all kinds. So how do I live complicit with that? I can't pretend that I'm not part of it. Every pig in a pigsty is muddy, no matter what that pig's intentions are, right? And we all live and move and have our being in the incredible messiness of American empire. So how do I articulate my convictions, acknowledging my complicity in the very thing that I oppose?
Let's take another short break. We'll be right back.
And we'll say, I'm gonna sing out, I'm gonna march on. And everybody said,
I'm gonna sing out,
gonna march on.
Speaking of Bush wanting peace, I remember when we were at the General Assembly in 2016, and the Peacemaking Committee wanted to get the perspective of the military on the five peace affirmations resolution. So they invited a military chaplain in to speak to the committee, and he began by saying, "All we want is peace. All we want is peace." And to be honest, I almost burst out laughing because it immediately reminded me of that marvelous song by Mel Brooks as he is playing Hitler and sings, "All I want is peace, peace, a little piece of Poland, a little piece of France, a little piece of Portugal and Austria, perchance." Now, as much as we all love our country, it seems more than a little ironic to say that all we want is peace when we have 800 military bases all around the world. We have invaded countries and overthrown democracies and sided with autocrats and tyrants against their own people. From the very beginning of our country, we have been very aggressive in our expansion into native lands with the westward expansion, the war with Mexico and taking over their lands from Texas to California, to the Spanish-American War when we took over Puerto Rico and Cuba and the Philippines. And most of these wars for expansion were fought against people of color. Now, we typically call these conquered lands territories, but they were really colonies of the American Empire, were they not? And that is part of the history that we seldom hear about or talk about. So here we are, four white men of privilege in U.S. American Empire. How should we approach or address the issue of our privilege, that tension between patriotism and the demands of justice? Any ideas on how that should be addressed?
Yeah, I have a thought about that. We are greatly privileged. I'm daily reminded of it. And when it slips from my consciousness, I have wonderful people around me that remind me of it. I think the thing for us is we have to use our privilege for good. We have to use our privilege for justice. We have to use it for peace. I would also say that all the things that have come with privilege, and I would include travel and cross-cultural encounters and seminary education for me during the height of feminism, and wonderful sisters in faith who were patient with my unexamined chauvinism and called me to task in a loving way, speaking truth to power and all that, speaking the truth in love. And I've benefited from every one of those uncomfortable encounters that brought me to a more enlightened place in my faith journey, and now I need to use those things. So if I've had powerful experiences with the underside of history, seeing from that perspective, that changes me. It has changed me. And I have to find partners who are working in the world that emerges when you take those things seriously. One example, our congregation offered sanctuary to a Honduran woman whose life was threatened, and she was facing deportation, ICE raids, all that stuff. We took her into sanctuary in our congregation, kept her there with us safely for about 2.5 years. And finally, she got her stay of deportation. She's doing fine now. But I remember, one of the things that we faced was, how can we support this one individual who's facing certain death if she's returned to her home country? And one of the things that we said as a congregation is we have the great privilege of having resources that we can share. And even though it means we've got to build a shower and we'll have Rosa here with us and needing 24-hour care and support, and we'll have to reach out to other congregations to get all the volunteer help we need to make that happen, that's the right and moral thing to do. That's what we're called to do as Christians. And we remember the words of an Episcopal priest whose church was also providing sanctuary. And he said, I will say that during the time we have been in sanctuary with Juan was his name, the presence of God has never been more vivid in our congregation. And that's, I think, part of it for me is we have to use the privilege we have, expecting that when we do that, the presence of God will be vivid among us.
And I also feel like to be a pacifist is to set aside my privilege a little bit. I mean, and I realize that it's easier for me to be a pacifist than someone who's, living in Honduras or El Salvador, where there's a lot of violence ingrained into the society. On a more interpersonal level, we know that a white man can own a gun and use it against a person of color and probably get away with it in a lot of places. Well, I choose not to have a gun for a lot of reasons, and that's one of them. I don't want to. That's an exercise of privilege that I want no part of. I also realized that the military-industrial complex exists in many ways to serve people like me. You know, it will help my retirement account if we go to war. Like if we, the more weapons we send to Ukraine, the better my retirement account looks, right? And the more we build this international global hegemony, the better my retirement account looks. But I don't want that. And I know that it will, you know, has the potential of harming my retirement. I want to turn away from it. I'd rather die in poverty than retire in luxury, knowing that my luxury is coming at a cost to people around the world. So I guess part of the way I respond to that, because this is a question which people on the left, with which people on the left challenge my pacifism. Well, it's easy for you to say, you know, like there's that whole thing that I think when people challenged liberation theology in Latin America, I mean, how dare you, they would say, how dare you make common cause with Marxists and revolutionaries? How dare you do violent stuff? And the response articulated by Gustavo Gutierrez and other people was like, well, we live in a violent society. We haven't changed that. And we're, you know, I know it's easier for me to be a pacifist than it is for people living in other parts of the world, but those people have to make their own choice and make their own decision. But I'm trying to turn in at least that little bit of my privilege by being a pacifist, saying I don't want it anymore.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that comes up for me is, you know, you've all said that Jesus is the reason for your pacifism. So why isn't that working in the churches? Why don't we see? Is it because we're not preaching Jesus? What is holding congregations back from recognizing this, that Jesus really is the Prince of Peace? I mean, every Advent, we celebrate the Prince of Peace, the coming of the Prince of Peace, and yet we are in the thrall of empire here. So what's the disconnect?
I think it has something to do with the cross. Mm-hmm. And the question that we don't ask ourselves often enough, I think, is how do we rest in that point where we're asked, what am I willing to die for? What am I willing to kill for? And to me, that, you know, there's an intersection, and I always try to think of that intersection in terms of the cross. And we're asking people to be willing to lay down their lives. And that's a big ask. I mean, it's what Jesus asked, right? And I think that happens in the Gospels a lot, that he reminds them that the path he's on is not going to be a path toward what we are enculturated to believe is victory. Mm-hmm.
I'll never forget after 9/11, I was driving around in the car listening to NPR, and they had this psychiatrist come on. And many people have said psychiatrists are the contemporary priests of our time, and not the pastors, not the people talking about Jesus, but the psychiatrists. Be that as it may, I found it interesting that this psychiatrist said, a terrible blow has been done to our national psyche, and we will never be whole until we exact our revenge.
Mm. Wow.
That's what was going out on the airwaves from the modern priests of our time, the secular priests. They were saying psychologically, we will never recover our self-esteem, our sense of wholeness until we are made whole. And the implication was, we have to go to war, we have to send a message, Otherwise, we will stay in this state of having been wounded. But the irony is that all over the world, people were saying, now you know what our life is like. Now we have a basis for solidarity with great America. You've been wounded. Join the rest of the world, you know. And there were many people who said that was a kairos moment for America to be different, to be radically different, to identify deeply in solidarity with the fellow suffering of their human being all over the world. And I mean, I remember, you know, Palestinians were saying this, Filipinos were saying this, people in Africa were saying this, people in Central America, you know, Tibetans, you know, I mean, everybody that's ever, you know, faced the wrath of the powers. And here we were, you know, fully armed. It was just a matter of time. And I remember the bombs started falling in October 7th, 2001, which October 7th is my birthday. I remember that was a Sunday. I was preaching and the bombs were falling in Afghanistan after 2001. It didn't take long at all for all these mechanisms to kick in. And so I think what I'm trying to say is, I think, you know, we do need to hold up Jesus's words. We do need to struggle authentically to live into them. I think we also need, and we are regularly reminded of these titanic forces we're up against that speak very convincingly to most people's psyches. And the word of the cross gets very easily trampled.
I would like to interview that psychiatrist 20 years on and say, so looking around, does the American psyche feel very whole to you at this point?
Yeah,
I mean, that is one fucked up school of psychiatry.
And no pushback from the NPR reporter.
No. Yeah. It's interesting. The church really dropped the ball, in my opinion, in that era. I mean, we have so many great examples of of Christian faith speaking out against war. I mean, I think that, for example, that the greatest, in my opinion, and this is probably because I'm a pacifist, I'm totally biased here, but my favorite Martin Luther King speech is the one he gave at Riverside Church a year before his death. You know, I think it's brilliant. But of course, a year later, he'd been assassinated. I think about the clear media control which was going on. I mean, like the Cleveland Plain Dealer and you know, just the inability and that NPR reporter, the inability of the press to stand up and say anything, the inability of our elected leaders. I mean, Barbara Lee, who I'm proud to say represents me in Congress, Barbara Lee was the only person to speak out against the war in the House of Representatives or the Senate. She was brilliant. I don't know if you've heard her speech against the war, but she actually quoted a hymn, and not just, you know, it was the hymn God of Grace and God of Glory, but it was like the fourth stanza of the hymn. I mean, this was a deeply church driven speech that she gave, but one person, and she got death threats for it. So is it any wonder that the path went out? I mean, that's what we did, present company excluded, but we wimped out as a profession. We wimped out. We didn't say anything. Because the cost is so high. I think Barbara Lee's probably still getting death threats for what she said. Martin Luther King, I don't know that he was assassinated as a result of his anti-war work, but, you know, it's at least symbolically ominous that great sermon against the war in Vietnam was a year to the day before he was assassinated. The cost was great. The blowback against me was relatively small, but I still felt it. You know, it was great.
Well, and Kennedy gave a tremendous speech at Georgetown. I think it was 6 months before he was assassinated, in which he said he planned to be a true peace president. He talked about taking deliberate attempts at dismantling the military-industrial complex. And within 6 months, Kennedy was assassinated. you can't draw a straight cause and effect line there, but many people have suggested that was when he was declared persona non grata by the powers that be.
Mm-hmm. And I remember being on the campus, university campus as campus minister, and talking with students about and asking them, as I felt that they were resisting our activities or conversations around war and resisting war, if they could remember any experiences in their local churches where they talked about war and violence and nonviolence, and not a single student had a conversation about that in their home church. Mm-hmm. So what do we need to do to help us to have conversations about this? What do we do to move the conversation forward here?
Let me just put a word in for those churches that were brave enough to have those conversations and how impactful though they were. I had an elder in my congregation who grew up in a sort of mainstream, big steeple Presbyterian church in Ohio. But she said it had a really good pastor who was alert to the signs of the times, and it would show up from time to time in his sermons. And they held a cover dish supper in the basement of the church, and the topic was the Vietnam War. And she said, as a young person, that had a huge impact on me. And she went on to devote her life to various kinds of peacemaking and other work, trying to live into that vision that was birthed in that conversation. So we don't have them nearly enough, but when we do have them, we have no way of knowing the incredible impact they can have. And, you know, I saw that. She talked about that with great gratitude and appreciation 35 years later.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think these kinds of conversations, you know, in you know, conversations that are had in public, even if it's a small public, it all helps. Everything we can write, everything that we can, you know, promote in a podcast like this, whatever it is, it all helps. And we may not actually see the impact right away, but you know, if we build a public record, if we build a public conversation, maybe future generations of peace activists will, you know, find this to be a good resource. I hope so. You know, we do have a problem, I think, which is that our younger people don't really have a lot of language for pacifism. Right? People in our, even in our Presbyterian Peace Fellowship, you know, we're very good at talking about a lot of really important stuff, and being anti-war isn't one of them. I mean, we're really good at talking about police violence. We're really good at talking about climate change. We're really good about talking about gun ownership and gun control issues. But we're not very good at talking about what do you do when your country goes and drops a bunch of bombs on innocent people in a foreign land. We don't have the language to speak about that. We have it, but we're not using it, I should say, as much as I think we could and probably should be. So I think we need to be trying to, those of us who are peace activists in sort of these progressive and left-leaning communities who are doing a lot of really good work, I think we need to insert ourselves a little more and challenge our contemporaries to speak out. To give a damn, and if they do give a damn, to speak out in ways that are difficult and hard and maybe even more challenging than some of these other issues that we're covering really well, and they're important. I'm glad we're doing it. I would just like to see us get better at talking about, you know, the violence of state-sponsored state-sponsored violence that is war.
I think that one of the things that I have seen over the years is that conversation around nonviolence is always around a tactic rather than an end, you know, a means, but not an end. And I think part of the language that we don't have or that we don't use is casting that vision of what we imagine a world of human flourishing to look like. I mean, I think always of King's beloved community, and we don't hold that up as, you know, we are about the work of building this world. Our work has to look like the end that we imagine. So whatever piece of the work you're engaged in, nonviolence is not a political tactic. It's not an activist tactic. It's not an organizing tool. It is the purpose of the organizing to build this community in which human beings can flourish, that does not rest on empire and violence and hierarchy. And to me, that's the language that ought to bind together all of the work that we do, is not distinctively anti-war. It's not distinctively anti-gun. It is cohesively and comprehensively about living into the kingdom of God, building up the beloved community, and understanding that that has to rest on structures that are radically democratic, that are accountable, that are transparent, that are non-hierarchical, because every hierarchy is a violence. And we have to dig into that over and over and over again and hold up the idea that we're not just learning how to do a nonviolent demonstration. We're learning how to live into this vision that we share.
Let me, I love that, David. And let me add a person who's been a guidepost for me is Emmanuel Katangole, who's at Notre Dame now. He was at Duke, founded the Center for Reconciliation here. He's an amazing pacifist. I mean, just read very briefly. It's in line of what you just said. He said, "Nonviolence is not a utopian fantasy. It is indeed a Christian vocation, as every Christian," I like this, he says, "is invited to enter the logic of God's love and discover its rich spiritual and practical dimensions. Violence is not inevitable. And there is a rich world of possibilities and alternatives available within the story of God's love. Surrounded by a cloud of witnesses, perhaps we too can dare to not only say no to violence, but to respond to violence through an excess of love. And when we do so, we find ourselves as part of the revolution of tenderness." Which is, I mean, it's what you're saying. It's this path of faithfulness, and it's not just a tactic, and we do it even when the tactics don't make any sense, or we try to do it, you know. Anyway, I like Captain Bully. He's good.
Yeah, I was gonna say it's what I'm saying, but it's said so much better. You know, that's beautiful.
Yeah,
and you know, and I think part of what it is, we have to sort of build these muscles for nonviolence. I like the term soul horse. That I think James Lawson uses so well, that these are muscles that we're not used to using, and we have to begin to exercise them. We have to realize that we have these muscles, and then how do we actually begin using them and building them up so that it becomes a natural reflex for us to use those muscles as opposed to the muscles of fight or flight.
It's interesting that running metaphor. I served a Black congregation in Dallas for a while as an interim, and one of the members of that church was the Olympian runner Michael Johnson, who for a long time set the record for, you know, the, whatever it was, the 100 meter or something. You know, he was an incredible sprinter, but he was very good in high school. But he went to Baylor University, and he said there was a coach there that deconstructed my whole way of running and reconstructed it in teaching me how to use muscles I didn't even know I had. Mm-hmm. And he said, I owe my gold medals to my coach who taught me how to run.
Well, I know that you all are busy, and I am incredibly grateful for this time that you all have given us to have this conversation together. And I would welcome us to get together again at another time if we want to continue this conversation. There's so much here. But I, like Ben was saying, I think that this is a beginning of a conversation that is needed in the church, and that we need to find ways of doing this that help us to continue this conversation and spread the conversation within our congregations and throughout the world. So any final remarks that any of you would care to make?
I tried to come up with something profound, but all I can think of is, Mark, I saw Michael Johnson with his gold medal in Atlanta.
Really?
I didn't see him win it. I saw him with it.
Wow.
It's like, wow. It was pretty cool.
I can say that I was privileged to be at a family picnic in Dallas where Michael was challenged by his younger brother to a foot race. And of course, it was no contest, but brother rivalries are what they are.
My younger brother just ran the Boston Marathon yesterday. Oh. And he's 60 years old, and he ran it in like 3 hours and 10 minutes. Like, he's
amazing. Amazing.
Last time I outran him was when I was a senior in high school and he was a freshman. So I feel for Michael Johnson's younger brother. I know just what that's like.
If I were you, I'd move that sibling competition into another sphere. Maybe play beat him in chess or something.
Yeah.
It was me. I don't know.
So to bring this back round, I mean, isn't this sort of part of what we have to navigate is the roots of violence? And some of, I mean, we're Cain and Abel, or, you know, David and Tim. Am I my brother's keeper? Well, yes. And to figure out how to navigate that conversation effectively and lovingly and supportively, because we all do recognize that there are those things that whose roots we don't understand, but whose effects we see very clearly.
Right. And I agree with that. And Jeff, I know you're trying to bring us to a close, but I just want to say this, that's, I think those conversations really need to happen. Super important. What I feel is true also is that I don't think we should enter into those conversations hoping they lead to peace. I think we should make peace so that we can have those conversations and start with the peacemaking work, and have that peacemaking work create the space that is necessary for us to have some of those really difficult questions about, you know, competitions and struggles and tribal animosities and national conflicts and all those kinds of things. But I think rather than working it all out so that we can have peace, I think we need to work for peace so that we can work it all out.
And I would just add lastly that I think we make a mistake when we allow ourselves to fall into silos. There are pacifists, and this is the pacifist solution. And then there are those that engaged in just war, and that their so-called solutions. I think there's a basis for cooperation between pacifists and non-pacifists who abhor war. And I think we should find ways to work together to stop war and not worry about the ideological stale debates about would you be violent to save your beloved wife from an invader? You know, that, you know, let's put that to the side. I probably would. But let's put that to the side and say, what's the basis for our common awareness that war is not the answer, however we come to that, and then let's work together. And that's in the spirit of what you said, Ben, that's a broader conversation. You don't have to sign a litmus test of I am a pacifist. You just have to be against war. And there are plenty of non-pacifists who abhor war and don't want to see us, you know, incinerate in a thermonuclear war or whatever, you know. So, yeah.
Amen to that.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Paul.
Thank you for calling us together,
Jeff. Thanks, Jeff.
Wonderful conversation. So blessings on your day.
Back at you, and good luck editing.
Really good to see all of you.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Benders of the Ark podcast, where we explore the stories of those who dare to do the hard work of social change and bending the arc of the moral universe toward justice. Be sure to subscribe and check out more stories and interviews at bendersoftheark.com. Our music is a splendid creation of Joshua Campbell titled Sing Out, March On. So until next time, keep bending the arc of the moral universe toward justice for creation and all of God's people.